This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provides signature support for our program. Matt Doyle is producing. Later, we're going to hear from Quinn Hillier, the esteemed conservative columnist and commentator, and with some thoughts about what's going on in the GOP and the deposing of Liz Cheney in the House, U.S. House, from her leadership position. But before we go there, we're in the toy department of life, Bobby Terrio, right fielder, Tommy DeMott, third baseman. 1961, LSU won the SEC baseball championship. And back in that time, LSU was a football school with an occasional basketball prowess person like Bob Pettit in the 50s and Pete Maravich in the 60s and in 1970. But usually it was football, and baseball at that time had a few football players who were major contributors, and 1961 was no exception. The team included Lynn Amedy, who was a star pitcher for the Tigers, and Roy Winston, who went on to become an NFL linebacker for 13 years and played in 4 Super Bowls for the Minnesota Vikings. But these guys were prominent members of Ray Didier's 1961 championship team, and it was quite a ride. They won in 11 innings, I believe, and Lynn Amedy, the aforementioned quarterback of the Tigers, was also a pitcher who went all 11 innings and threw probably close to 200 pitches. But that's the way it was done in those days. And tomorrow they will gather 11 members of the team for a reunion at the Jack and Donny Museum on Lakeshore Drive. And Bobby, let's begin with you. Many people in our community will know this man from Lafayette who logged 38 years at Merrill Lynch. But in 1961, you were a young lad, and it was pretty good winning the SEC, wasn't it?
Oh, we had a lot of fun. It was a great time. It was a very, very close team. We had great pitching, timely hitting, and a wonderful defense. Our infield was very, very strong.
And one of the members of the infield was third baseman Tommy DeMott by way of Youngstown, Ohio. How did you end up at LSU?
I was recruited mostly in basketball and baseball, and I ended up had an opportunity to go to Arizona. But my football coach, Tony Mason, who was also at Cincinnati and the University of Arizona coach, I was personal friends with Paul Dietzel and so forth. And so that was a pretty easy decision to have someone, because I'd never been out of Ohio at that time except playing different sports. But a young 18-year-old to get away from home, I wanted a little company, and there it was.
Well, Bud Johnson, who was the publicist for your team, has noted that more than a few football players were on that team, and it not only included Amedy and Winston, but would have included Jimmy Field, the other quarterback, but Paul Dietzel wouldn't allow all of his quarterbacks to play baseball that year, so Field missed out on the championship of 1961. I understand he will be at the reunion, though.
Well, Jimmy kind of has adopted us. He played with us the next year, and he was a great athlete, as you know. And so he has a very strong tie to our team and everybody on it.
Well, in those days, and of course I came to LSU, 16 years later as a freshman, but the stadium was not full, and it was the old Alex Box Stadium. But back in the day, 1946, Joe Adcock, one of the great sluggers of his generation, played for the Tigers and led LSU to a championship, and it took 15 years, and in 1961, you won it all. And how was baseball in those days? Was it an afterthought, or was it something that was big on campus?
It was basically an afterthought. In fact, we finally filled the stadium for a doubleheader against Ole Miss. And it was the first time in the history of that campus that the stadium had been full. Yeah. And as we continued to win, then our attendance continued to grow so that by the end of the year we were getting good crowds. But at the start of the year, if we had a couple hundred people, that was a big crowd.
Yeah. Couple of hundred, and you won the SEC title. How things have changed. Lots of pressure now on the LSU coach to succeed at high levels, and just about every team in the SEC is loaded with talent. And the rumors continue to circulate that Paul Maneri may be calling it a career, and he's had a great career. He's among the 10 winningest coaches in the history of the game. Your coach was Ray Didier. What kind of a guy was he?
I have to agree with Bobby. I think he'll agree with me on this. He was very fundamental. We looked at basics mostly. At every position, we knew who to back up. We went through it on a daily basis by hours and hours of practice, who backed up who, what position you were at. And that won a lot of games for us because we knew each other. We knew very seldom, we were talking about it just recently, that very few balls fell in between a person because we knew who had the overcall from the outfield or the infield. So we were very, a lot of communication.
You're hearing the voice of Tommy DeMott, and you can hear by that voice that he is from Youngstown, Ohio, and Bobby Terrio, pride of Lafayette. They both converged and were on a championship team 60 years ago. I'm sure it's hard for you to fathom that that much time has passed, but it has. And Bud Johnson, the aforementioned SID, has a question saying, what was, you mentioned the infield, Bobby, what was so special about it?
Well, we were a pretty fast team. And we had great speed in the infield as well as wonderful. They covered a lot of ground as well as great fielders. Larry Edmondson, who actually was one of the basketball players, it was a basketball scholarship at LSU, played second base for us. And, I mean, Larry covered more ground than anybody I've ever seen. Then Johnny Thomas was at shortstop, and he was fast, and he covered a lot of ground and had a great arm. And then Tommy was at third, and Tommy could throw a cannon from third to first base. And so we, you know, I laughed. I was the right fielder. I said I hardly ever had to worry about fielding a ground ball. Larry got most of them.
Well, I remember Jim Smith was the coach when I arrived, and he also was a football manager, equipment manager, and that was his major job. And, in fact, he was your coach briefly as well. So that shows you how baseball was de-emphasized at LSU at the time. And you can see crowds of 200. Today, an LSU baseball star, like football players and basketball players, they can parlay that if they play it right in the business world. But when you went to work at Merrill Lynch, I bet most people never knew that you were part of an SEC champion baseball team at LSU.
That's true.
But the game is the same game, but it is, the stakes are much higher, and of course there's pressure, but then you got coach making close to $1 million a year. Yeah. I wonder what Ray Didier earned in those days.
Well, 25?
25,000, maybe. Well, that was good money then.
I was going to say the same
thing. That was out in 1961. 60, yeah. I bet he didn't make 25,000. I don't think he did because Dietzel didn't make 25,000 in those days. But this was right in the prime of Paul Dietzel, who ended up leaving at the end of 61 after going 10-1, finishing in top three in the nation after winning a national title in 1958. At age of 37, he hightailed it. Football was supreme then. Were you around when Billy Cannon was going strong, or was that a little bit before your time?
We were there in 59 for Cannon's run.
Right. You were in the stadium, right?
Right.
We were freshmen, yeah.
Yeah.
You were probably one of the million people who were in Tiger Stadium October 31, 1959, right?
Who really was there.
Yeah. Here's a question from Tom on Bluebonnet asking, did you live in an athletic dorm in those days?
We used to live in the Pentagon.
And
so that wasn't an athletic dorm, though.
No. And what would happen then is at semester when the senior football players and would move out, they would fill it with us from the Pentagon. We would move from the Pentagon to Broussard Hall.
But Broussard is where the football players stayed.
Football players.
The basketball players stayed in our dorm, too, most of them.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not even sure the Pentagon was air-conditioned in those days, was it?
No.
No, and I lived in a non-air-conditioned dorm. Actually, two of them, Hodges and the stadium. And the stadium, just because of where it's situated and how it's built, it was much cooler than Hodges Hall. But I bet the Pentagon was just steaming hot at times.
Yeah. It was warm.
It was warm. But all these years later, you've stayed close. You have stayed in touch, and it's touching because now do the math. I suspect most of you are past 80 years old, and you made some lifelong friends.
Yeah, we were a very close team at the time, and thanks to Bud Johnson for our 50th anniversary, he got us all together really for the first time officially. And we had so much fun and reuniting with everybody that we decided we would continue to get together. So we get together every 5 years now, and everybody comes that's around.
Well, that's wonderful. And tomorrow they will gather at the Andone Museum. It's not open to the public, but it will be a festive event for the 1961 LSU championship team. Johnny Downtown says, who are the best players that you played with or against?
Well, best player that I think that we played with, Tommy, I would have to say John Bailey in center field was an incredible athlete.
Very good.
And Alan Smith was an All-American pitcher for us, so obviously he
ten,
was
10-2.
10-2 was our best pitcher. Probably the best. We played against some great athletes. Ole Miss had Jake Gibbs, who caught for the Yankees for many years, and they had Doug Elmore, who was quite an athlete.
And both of those guys played football, as we know. They were both on the field when Cannon ran 89 yards.
Don Kessinger was there.
Yeah, Don Kessinger played years with the Cubs next to Ron Santo at third base. Glenn Beckert at second. Ernie Banks at first.
I think he managed also 1 year. Yeah.
Well, thanks and congrats. And glad you're keeping the flame alive.
Appreciate it.
Tommy DeMond.
Thank you.
And Bobby Terrio. We'll be back with Quinn Hillier after this timeout. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana, and great to see Bobby Terrio and Tommy DeMond. And Tommy is mentioned from Youngstown, Ohio, when he came to LSU and played for the 61 SEC title team, celebrating its 60th anniversary. And both gentlemen noted that they faced a pitcher from Mississippi State named Sammy Ellis, who struck out 18 Tigers and lost. Sammy Ellis went on to pitch for the Cincinnati Reds and won 22 games in 1965 for the Reds with Pete Rose and Frank Robinson, among others. Quinn Hillier is with us, the esteemed columnist and commentator from the right side of the political spectrum. He's based in Mobile but grew up in New Orleans and I think still calls Louisiana home for good reason. That's where it all began, and his roots are deep in our state. If you'd like to talk with him, 877-217-5757. And as we know, as we've talked to Quinn over the last 5 years, he's been an opponent of the former president, Donald John Trump, since the day that Trump announced his candidacy. He announced in New York City, as we know, but his first big rally was at Ladd People's Stadium in Mobile, Alabama. And Quinn was there, and that was 2015. And here we are going on 6 years later, and we're still talking about the man, even though he lost by 7 million votes to Joe Biden in 2020. Quinn Hillier, Donald Trump's the gift that keeps on giving when it comes to talking about what's going on in our world, because he is so important to the GOP flock. And I think Clay Higgins, who at times is awkward, as we know, does put things in perspective, and his numbers may be exaggerated, but he says 100 million Americans support President Trump and Liz Cheney doesn't, so Liz Cheney had to go when it came to her leadership post in the GOP. You look at it differently, but I'm sure you are fully aware of the mojo that Donald Trump continues to carry within the ranks of some members of the GOP.
Well, yes. Look, it is absolutely clear that a large majority of self-identified Republicans still support Trump, would support him again for president. But if that's all you look at and you're a Republican leader, you're being very short-sighted. Let's play a what-if game. On January 7th, Republicans had just lost, unimaginably lost, not one, but two Georgia Senate seats that they were expected to win, which meant they lost control of the Senate. It was entirely Donald Trump's fault. He depressed his own side's turnout in numerous ways, and he cost Republicans the Senate. And then he instigated, in effect, a riot, which, you know, maybe you can say his exact words didn't instigate it. But once it was going on, once he knew that people were in danger and that people were specifically yelling for the head of his vice president, kill Mike Pence, he was still tweeting out incendiary things against his own vice president. If, after that horrible 3 days, every leader in the Republican Party had said, Donald Trump has gone too far, he was lying about the election, and he now put our democracy at risk, we don't want to have anything to do with it. If they all stood up and had the guts to tell the truth and to take a stand, then he would not be in the position that he still is, which is a total kingmaker, if they had the guts. But they did not. And so he is still bedeviling them. They can't put him behind them, and they come out looking like weaklings because they get rid of a very solidly conservative leader in favor of a liberal leader, at least Stefanik, or at least liberal by Republican standards, all because the good leader that they have wouldn't kiss Donald Trump's ring. That makes them look like weaklings, and it's pathetic.
Why do you think there was this, and continues to be this, allegiance to Donald Trump within the Republican ranks?
Political cowardice. Absolute political cowardice. And short-sightedness. They are afraid. They know that that in the short term, Donald Trump clearly controls a lot of votes. There are, as I said at the beginning, a majority of the self-identified Republican electorate still supports him. Of course, what they're ignoring is how many former Republicans Trump has turned off. And all they had to do is say, okay, we can have different opinions about Trump, but as long as Liz Cheney leads us well on everything else, she's okay, because we're allowed to have differences of opinion. That would send a message to suburbia, which turned heavily against Trump and the Republicans. It would send a message to non-Trump Republicans, of which, even though they're a minority, it's a very substantial minority, it would send a message that you're welcome in the party, too. And it would grow the party rather than sending the message that unless you are a sycophant and a cultist for Trump, you're not welcome. What they're doing is turning off votes, and if they have turned off votes, they deserve it.
877-217-5757 for Quinn Hillier. We will go to the phone lines in just a moment. It was a voice vote, and in the Louisiana delegation, the only ones who publicly stated they were in favor of the removal of Cheney were Clay Higgins and Steve Scalise. Now, Mike Johnson didn't say, neither did Garrett Graves, neither did Julia Ledlow, but it's assumed that they were complicit in the removal of Liz Cheney. What does that say about the Louisiana delegation, which I'm sure mirrors most delegations? There weren't many Republicans speaking out for Liz Cheney when this happened.
Well, it does mirror most delegations, because very few people had the guts to stand on principle and say, you know, we're allowed differences of opinion, especially when the person expressing the difference of opinion is doing so in truth and in integrity. You can go back and look. There is not a single person writing for a national publication who has written more good things for longer and has known Steve Scalise for longer than I have, but I'm very disappointed with him. Somebody needs to ask him why he would replace a solid conservative like Liz Cheney, and you can check every vote counting record, every interest group out there that measures liberal versus conservative, and she's a solid conservative. Why he would replace her with one of the most liberal Republicans in the House, somebody that voted for the Equality Act, which critics say would force girls to compete against biological males, why she voted against Donald Trump's tax cuts, which Republicans say is what made the economy go so well before the COVID hit, why she has a bad record on voting issues across the board from a Republican standpoint. Steve Scalise, why would you support her over a solid conservative?
Patrick in Innisfail Estates. Patrick, please be brief. You're on with Quinn.
Hey, I voted for Ted Cruz. I didn't necessarily vote for Donald Trump. It has nothing to do with that, Donald Trump. It has to do with the voter fraud that occurred. And, you know, Jim, I've listened to your show for years. You bring up JFK conspiracies. You brought up Russian collusion conspiracies. And yet all of a sudden there's no conspiracy here. And I agree, not every conspiracy is true, but there was no investigation done.
All right, there was an investigation done, a very thorough investigation, Patrick, and it showed no widespread voter fraud, at least not enough to swing the election to Donald Trump. And no state that was won by Joe Biden was won by fewer than 10,000 votes. So we're not talking about 537 votes in Florida or even 5,788 votes in Louisiana when Woody Jenkins beat lost to Mary Landrieu. Quinn Hillier, this mantra of voter fraud continues, and people like Patrick are buying into it.
If you go back and look, again, I hate to cite myself, but I have written more than just about anybody saying that over the past 30 years, vote fraud is very real. Vote fraud is much more real than most in the media are willing to admit. I've documented it. I have explained what how it can be fought against. And yet, me, Mr. Vote Fraud Exists, agree, because the facts are the facts, that there was not enough widespread vote fraud here to overturn the election.
We're going to continue with Quinn Hillier, and we'll go back to the phones with Jim and Walker after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Quinn Hillier, the well-known conservative columnist and commentator, is with us for one more segment. And we're discussing what's happening in the national GOP, which has become the party of Donald John Trump. Even though he's in exile in Florida, he continues to pack a wallop with the Republican ranks. And that was in full display this week when Liz Cheney, who's a ardent critic of the former president, was deposed from her number three post in the U.S. House among Republicans because she voted for the impeachment of President Trump, and she also said he incited the insurrection of January 6th. Quinn's with us. If you'd like to join the conversation, 877-217-5757. Jim and Walker, thanks for your patience. Jim, you're on with Quinn.
Good morning. There no longer is any morality or integrity left in the GOP. It has just devolved into the party of hatred, greed, division, and obstruction. They claim to be strict constitutionalists, but are in fact against everything the founders believed in and fought for. It's absolutely pathetic that for a GOP politician, the litmus test is no longer their conservative bona fides, but their willingness to repeatedly kiss one man's behind in public.
All right. Is that fair or is that hyperbole, Quinn?
There is truth in it. I think it's a little bit hyperbolic, but there is certainly grounds to say some of that. The integrity seems sorely lacking. I would caution, though, that it is pretty bad on both sides, and that if you look at what Joe Biden and the Biden administration are doing, they're not exactly being honest either. He keeps acting like he's a moderate, and yet even Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is saying, my goodness, I'm thrilled. Because I didn't expect him to be so progressive, read hard leftist. It would have been nice if he campaigned on some of these left-wing things that he's doing. So it runs both ways. But in terms of how the Republicans are acting now, yes, they are showing a definite lack of integrity.
A listener asks a good question. This is Hal in Monroe listening online. He says, what would have happened, Quinn, and this is one of those hypotheticals, but if Mitt Romney had defeated Barack Obama in 2012 when President Obama was seeking a second term, we would have lost the second term of Obama and Biden, but we also would not have had the first term of Trump and Pence. It's an interesting thought, isn't it?
Well, it is, and people forget that race was really, really close until about the last week. Actually, even going into the last day, a lot of people thought it was very much up in the air, and all the early exit polls misleadingly showed that it was going to be an absolute nail biter. I mean, this is exit polls from Election Day itself. What would have happened? We would have had a moderate Republican administration that would have promoted centrism, slightly right of center centrism. And maybe the country would not be so divided right now. But then again, you know, who knows? It could have been that that attempt at censorship flopped, and we would have still ended up with somebody like Donald Trump. We just don't know, but it's definitely an interesting question.
I don't know if there is anyone like Donald Trump, though. There may be people who share his views, and by the way, Trump's views have been malleable, as we know. 15 years ago, he was still a Democrat and supporting Hillary Clinton, so he is a party of himself, and his personality is so captivating for many people that they have latched on to him and will follow him anywhere he goes, Quinn. And you, as a Republican, don't think that's going to a good spot. So where does it end? Is it over, or is it going to continue with him as the 2024 nominee of your party?
That's a good question. I mean, just about anything can happen. I'll tell you what, if the Republican leadership, both in the Republican National Committee and in both houses of Congress, if they don't start making an independent effort to show some substance of their own apart from Donald Trump, the Republican Party will go down in flames. Because Trump, while he has a very strong base of support within the Republican Party, he clearly has only a minority of support in the country. He barely lost the electoral vote, but you're right. He lost the popular vote by 7 million people, which is huge, and he's not going to do any better than that.
But he's never cracked 47%. He hasn't gotten to 47% in two elections. But
My point exactly.
I think his hope, and this has nothing to do with the qualifications of Kamala Harris, who I think would be okay as president, but others do not. And, of course, she's a double minority or a triple minority, depending on how you look at it. I think Trump is probably calculating that he could get a race against her and that that might enable him to win an election. That's my conjecture. What do you think?
Well, that's true. And it's not because she's a triple minority. It's because she is a radical leftist.
Well, that's your point of view, but keep going.
Well,
keep going.
I've written columns where I documented it. You know, she was, her voting record was farther to the left than Bernie Sanders was, for goodness sakes. So, I mean, that calculation of his is not necessarily off base. But if that happens, you know, again, the country is going to be bitterly divided, and everybody's going to say that the only reason she's at risk of losing is because of her minority status, which will not be true. And, you know, you'll have the worst of both worlds. And
well,
so I'm hoping somehow Republicans mm-hmm. get enough guts to find a way to force Donald Trump off the stage.
James in Metairie. Hi, James. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Well, good morning to you, Jim. There's a second big lie that's going on. First of all, Liz Cheney, obviously, the big lie that the election was stolen from Donald Trump. But yesterday, there was a House Oversight Committee hearing in which two Republican representatives from Georgia downplaying what happened on January the 6th. You know, over 140 Capitol Police officers were injured. Two committed suicide. And yet we have this Representative Jody Heise, H-I-C-E, who is now saying that the Trump supporters were the real victims. They were the ones who lost their lives that day, he said. It was not Trump supporters who were taking the lives of others. We're living in bizarro world, Jim.
All right. Quinn, your thoughts about James and Metairie's comments.
I think Congressman Heise is returning to the lady who was totally illegally and dangerously climbing through the window that she had broken, and she was shot and killed, and that was very unfortunate. It was also a defensible use of force. The caller is right. This was a horrible assault on our democratic institutions, deliberately aimed at stopping a sacred rite and ritual of our democracy, which is the official counting of the electoral votes, in hopes that somehow, if you stop the counting, that the election wouldn't count. That's what they were trying to do, It was misguided, it was dangerous, and in some cases it was evil, and some of them were trying to kill Vice President Pence, and it was inexcusable. And for these congressmen to say that somehow the Trump people were the victims is disgusting. The caller is right.
Another listener, Holly in the Garden District, asks about Pence. Where is he?
Pence is very carefully positioning himself. He's got a sort of a new political organization. He's also now affiliated with the very thoughtful think tank, the Heritage Foundation. He is starting to make speeches, and he's going to be laying out a vision. Like, you don't have to agree with him being obsequious to Trump, and you don't have to, you know, like his issues, but he's a man of integrity, which he showed when he defied Trump and said, no, I have a duty here.
Tom in Woodland Ridge. Tom, you're on with Quinn.
Hey, good morning, Jim. Good morning, Quinn. What do you think of the theory that Trump actually could probably be a successful or at least a strong kingmaker for the next presidential candidate, but his ego just will not allow him to be in the background? And so he's either going to want to be up front or nothing at all.
I think that's absolutely right, except he will never accept being nothing at all, which means that unless he is forced out of the way, he will be up front.
Dan, downtown.
Very astute comment, though.
Dan, you're on with Quinn.
Yeah. Has the GOP put its bet on voter suppression and gerrymandering to, you know, if not thrive, at least survive?
What about?
No, voter suppression is a completely ridiculous, overblown charge from the left. I have seen less evidence of voter suppression than of voter fraud. And as I said, there was clearly not enough voter fraud to swing this last election, which means if there was even less voter suppression than voter fraud, then we don't have to worry about that.
The election of 2020, I think it's fair to say, though, Quinn, sparked many of these changes in laws in southern states primarily about how people vote.
And most of them are still leaving laws more liberalized than they were in 2019. What they are doing is codifying some of the temporary changes that were made due to the pandemic and accepting some and saying that some of them were only emergencies. They are not voter suppression at all. And
all right, we'll be back to wrap it up with Quinn. This is Jim Inkster with producer Matt Doyle and special guest Quinn Hillier for just a few more moments, and then we go to Mary Stein from the East Baton Rouge Parish Library. Big day tomorrow on Goodwood. In the New York Times today, actually this was yesterday's story, but it says in a remarkable display of loyalty to Donald Trump, Republicans moved quickly to purge Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming from House leadership on Wednesday, voting to oust their number three for repudiating the former president's election lies, as the Times puts it, and holding him responsible for the deadly January 6th riot at the Capitol. The action orchestrated by party leaders came by voice vote during a raucous closed-door meeting on Capitol Hill that lasted just 15 minutes. What's next for Liz Cheney?
Liz Cheney is now basically the leader of the non-Trump Republican forces. She is a solid conservative. She will have a difficult but still winnable race for re-election in Wyoming, and if she does win, as I expect, then she will be able to say that Trump threw everything he had at me and I still beat him, which means that Trump is actually a paper tiger. And so she is going to keep fighting both Trump and fighting the left and saying if people will respect her for it.
Final caller for Quinn. Tom, actually, it's Ray in Prairieville who's been waiting patiently. Ray, good morning.
No, thanks for taking my call, Jim. And I think you've set a record for listener response. I didn't count them, but there's a lot of them. Mr. Hillier, the biggest thing I see is we almost need a three-party system. I'm a conservative, but I'm a liberal on social issues, and I'd like to see moderate or independent party because I don't want to go full left, but I sure don't, sure not happy with the far right.
Well, I am coming around to your view, and I think actually having a third party could stop the polarization that's out there, because both parties would then need, both existing parties would need to move to the middle to try to get back as much of the middle as they can to keep the third party from taking their votes. So I think you're very wise, sir. I hope it happens.
Thank you, Quinn Hillier. Always good to catch up with you. Appreciate your insights.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Jim.
Thanks. And in studio is the incomparable Mary Stein of the East Baton Rouge Parish Library. You can find her most days smiling broadly at the beautiful location on Goodwood, which is one of the showplaces of the city and one of the best libraries in North America. And tomorrow, the One Book, One Community celebration reaches a culmination with a live stream event at 2 p.m. What's going on, Mary Stein?
Well, Jim, we're going to make some COVID lemonade tomorrow. We had focused on the book, The Yellow House, by Sarah M. Broom. No relationship to Mayor Broom. I get that question a lot.
And the mayor's daughter.
That's right, and the mayor's daughter, Sarah. They're not the same person. This is National Book Award winner Sarah M. Broom, who wrote The Yellow House, which was our One Book, One Community title for the spring. And we've been doing programs since February based around the themes of the book. But she and Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, the author of The Revisioners, also a New Orleans author, a book set in Louisiana, and a book that follows families in New Orleans and families in Louisiana, will join us virtually. We had hoped to have them here in person, but as you know, the COVID landscape varies from state to state, and these two authors are not currently living in Louisiana. And as late as the end of April, it seemed like they were going to come, but then they're not coming. Wow. So they're going to join us virtually, and we're going to have a live watch party, and we'll be able to talk to them through the wonders of technology, just like you, Jim.
Well, they are two of the best, and they are Louisianians, and they have both gotten national and even international attention for their work.
Yes.
Yellow House was your selection, and that book has taken a life of its own.
It really has, and just because, like with all of our One Book, One Community selections, there's something in it for everyone. Every perspective, you really get to walk a mile in a lot of different people's shoes in that, in The Yellow House, because it follows a very large, widespread family. And just as so many families are in today's world, there are multiple family units within the family, different fathers, different people raise the children. And The Yellow House is what she calls Ivory Mae's 13th and most unruly child. There were 12 human children, and then there was The Yellow House.
Well, Sarah Broom won the 2019 National Book Award for her first novel, I believe.
Well,
Yellow House.
Yeah, and really it's autobiographical. We probably wouldn't even call it a novel. We don't always pick fiction for our topics, but it reads like a novel. It's very lyrically written, so it's not pedantic.
Yeah, it is for nonfiction, you're correct.
Yeah.
And so it's amazing that she's had this rise, kind of like John Kennedy Toole, who,
yeah,
of course, got his accolades after he died, but she was born in 1979 on New Year's Eve in New Orleans, youngest of 12 children.
That's right. So this Yellow House really is Sarah's story, but it's her family's story, and it's kind of through the lens of not just the Yellow House, but New Orleans. New Orleans is a character, and it's New Orleans East. So that's something I'm not familiar with, and so I was really enjoying, again, walking through Sarah's eyes as she interviewed all the family members and told the story long before her birth of this part of town. So if you're interested in cultural geography, it's there. If you're interested in Mr. Go, it's there. If you're interested in Katrina and Restore Louisiana, it's there. If you're interested in home decor, it's there. Or the idea of living on the second floor in the French Quarter and hearing the saxophone sounds kind of trail lazily up into the air, and then working in the service industry in the huge restaurant industry in New Orleans pre-Katrina.
Tomorrow, 2 p.m., live stream event at the main library on Goodwood Boulevard. Mary Stein will be there. And also featured is Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, another New Orleanian. She studied creative writing at Dartmouth and law at the University of California, so she's highly educated. And her book has not gotten quite as much attention as The Yellow House, but The Revisioners, which is a novel, mm-hmm. has been acclaimed, and you say for very good reason.
Oh, yeah. So a good story, definitely fiction. And it seems like you're talking about current times, but the past informs the present and the future. So a black woman, a white woman living side by side, way back in 1920s, and then worlds collide again in the modern era through their children, grandchildren, et cetera. So I'm really looking forward to it. Now, since it's a watch party, we had limited seating because of COVID, and all those seats are taken at the main library, though we are going to live stream it outside in the beautiful plaza, and we're live streaming it on YouTube and Facebook and several other ways. So you can be part of it, and then, of course, we'll keep the archive mm-hmm. for a couple of weeks.
All right. Here's Malia on Ardenwood asking how you choose the One Book, One Community recipient every year.
Well, that's a really good question, Leah. And in the early days, we were going to the canon of American literature or even British literature because we were choosing our books through the grant called The Big Read, and you had to pick from their list. And then as we got more experienced in the project, we started looking for Louisiana books. We featured the Kingfish. We right. have featured some other things about Louisiana. But we're looking for something with broad appeal that's engaging, primarily for adults. But if there can be a teen or juvenile crossover, we really like that. For example, with Hidden Figures, there's a young person's version. There was a great movie. It was on audio. So it checked all the boxes, and it was engaging, and that's the number one thing. And it gave us something to think about, to talk about, and to springboard programs from.
Mary Stein will be there tomorrow, 2 p.m., free yep. and open to the public.
Of course.
One Book, One Community Award Watch Party, and a culmination of a year with Sarah Broom's Yellow House, and also featured Margaret Wilkerson Sexton, The Revisioners. Who are some of your favorite writers?
Well, I will tell you, especially during COVID, like so many Americans, I have been binge reading my old favorites.
Yeah.
And my favorites are usually mysteries, especially if there's a little bit of comedy or science fiction. So I binge read Robert Heinlein. I've binge read Janet Ivanovich. I've been binge read Andy Carpenter mysteries with the dog. And then in my science fiction lines, Terry Pratchett wins the award because he will take you away from this world. So that's what I've been doing.
And soon, at what point will you announce the One Book, One Community Award winner for 2022?
Well, if there is a Louisiana State Book Festival, you will hear the title then.
That would be what, in November?
In November. The last weekend of October or the early weekend in November, we're still waiting. Okay. We hope that's going to happen.
That would be good.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hope it happens.
Because I know what it is.
It really?
Yeah.
Do we get a
like
hint?
It. No.
Well, we'll hopefully find out first.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mary Stein.
Thank you, Jim.
Thanks for listening. First Financial Tax and Accounting Services provide signature support until Monday. Stay safe and stay tuned.